Dr. Elise Hartman built her career on trust. With a calm voice and steady hands, she helped survivors of deep emotional wounds find their footing again. Her private practice was a sanctuary, structured, safe, sacred. Until the day Caleb Monroe walked in, he said he was a victim of childhood abuse, said he couldn't sleep, said he needed help. Elise, ever the professional, believed him. She offered him compassion, a treatment plan, and her full attention. But what began as therapy slowly unraveled into something else, something far more dangerous. Caleb wasn't just another client. He was magnetic, unpredictable, and seductive in a way Elise had never experienced. What started as empathy turned to infatuation, and then into something darker. Secrets, betrayal, blackmail. By the time Elise realized who Caleb really was, it was too late. The trauma he described was a lie, carefully constructed to infiltrate her life and the lives of the vulnerable women she had sworn to protect. This wasn't a love story. It was a setup. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. It started on a Tuesday morning, the kind of day Elise liked best. Rain pattering softly against the windows, her diffuser sending out lavender, and a blank hour ahead. She always arrived early, adjusted the angle of her chair, reviewed her notes, and mentally prepared for the emotional weight her clients would unload. Then came the buzz at the door, her next intake, a new name on the calendar, Caleb Monroe, age 31, referred by a crisis hotline, no insurance on file, no history listed, a blank slate. Elise opened the door, and there he stood, tall, dark-haired. He wore a grey hoodie under a black coat, damp from the drizzle. His eyes, deep-set and green, scanned her like he already knew her. He gave a shy, almost boyish smile as he stepped in. "You're Dr. Hartman?" he asked, voice quiet but certain. "I am. You must be Caleb." They shook hands. His grip was firm, but not aggressive. He smelled faintly of cedar and cold air. She led him in. Motioning toward the client chair across from her own, he sat, body loose but attentive, fingers twitching slightly, as if holding back nervous energy. Elise clicked her pen and opened her notebook. "So, Caleb, what brings you in today?" He paused. Not the usual pause. Not hesitation. Calculation. Then he leaned forward, elbows on knees, voice low. "I don't sleep. I haven't slept more than 2 hours a night in months. I get these flashes, memories, or maybe they're nightmares. I can't tell anymore." Elise nodded slowly. "Do you know what they're about?" He looked down. "My father, he used to..." His throat caught. "There was a shed behind our house. He'd lock me in when I disobeyed, sometimes for hours, sometimes all night. He'd leave me there in the dark." The words came slowly, perfectly spaced, enough to sound raw, real. Elise felt something tighten in her chest. She had heard so many trauma stories, so many broken voices, but something about this, his eyes, the detail, the restraint, hit her harder than she expected. She softened her tone. "That sounds terrifying, Caleb. Thank you for trusting me with that." He exhaled like he'd been holding the memory too long. "I haven't told anyone, not even my last therapist. I walked out on her after 2 sessions. Elise tilted her head slightly. "Why?" "She seemed scared of me," he said, "like I was too much." Elise felt a quiet flicker inside. Not fear, but curiosity. He continued, "I need someone who can handle it, who doesn't flinch." "You're not too much," Elise said. Their eyes locked, a beat too long. Then she quickly glanced down to her notes. Over the next 50 minutes, Caleb offered small pieces of his past, a controlling father, a mother who looked the other way, nights spent sleeping in cars, relationships that always ended the same way, women calling him intense, unavailable, manipulative. Elise asked follow-ups, kept things professional, but her mind, usually sharp and focused, drifted more than once. He was articulate, vulnerable, but not broken, strong, but somehow needy. When the session ended, he didn't rush out like others. He lingered near the door. "Will you take me on?" he asked. "As a regular client." Elise hesitated. She had a full caseload. She should refer him. A man with unprocessed childhood trauma, potential attachment issues that required boundaries, structure. She should say no. But what came out was, "Yes, I think we can work together." He smiled again, not shy this time. "Good," he said. "I think you're the only one who can help me." That night, Elise sat at home on her couch, glass of wine in hand, laptop open but ignored. Her mind wandered back to Caleb. She told herself it was normal. First sessions always lingered, but deep down, she knew this wasn't about empathy. It was something else, a pull, an echo of something she couldn't name. 3 weeks later, he hadn't missed a session. He was always on time, always brought something deeper. At session four, he cried for the first time, talked about his first girlfriend who'd disappeared after a pregnancy scare. He blamed himself, said he had a pattern of pushing people away when they got close, that he didn't deserve love. "I feel safe here," he whispered, "with you." Elise felt the words in her gut. They hung in the air longer than they should have. "I'm glad," she said quietly. "But remember, this space is for healing, not for attachment." He looked up, eyes glassy. "But what if you're the only one who ever saw me?" By week six, he had started bringing her little things, a cup of coffee, a plant for her office, a playlist he said reminded him of their talks. She refused the first few gifts, but by week eight, she was listening to the playlist in her car. It happened in session 10. They were talking about fear. Caleb was describing a recurring dream, one where he was drowning in a dark lake and no one reached for him. Elise reached forward without thinking and touched his hand. It was brief, a gesture of reassurance, but he didn't let go, and neither did she. For 5 seconds, the room shifted. Time stretched. Then she pulled away, flustered. "I shouldn't have done that." He said nothing, just smiled. That night, he emailed her. "Not about therapy. I know the rules, but I think we both felt it. I won't cross the line. Unless you want me to." Elise stared at the screen for hours. She didn't respond, but she didn't delete the message either. 2 weeks later, the affair began like most disasters do. Slow, justified, rationalized. It started with a coffee outside the office, then a kiss in her car, then weekend texts, then a hotel room. She told herself she'd end it after that, but she didn't. She kept seeing him, both in the office and outside of it. She stopped billing him. Stopped taking notes. She didn't care, or so she thought. Until a woman named Naomi, one of Elise's long-time trauma clients, came in shaking. "I think someone's been watching me," Naomi whispered. "A man. He followed me home twice. I saw him again this morning near my building." Elise felt a chill crawl across her spine. What did he look like? Naomi hesitated. He had dark hair, tall, a hoodie. I only saw his face once. He was just staring. She showed Elise a rough sketch she made from memory. Elise's blood turned to ice. It looked just like Caleb. Elise didn't sleep that night. She kept staring at Naomi's crude sketch until it blurred in her vision. She wanted to believe it was coincidence. Caleb lived in the city. Plenty of people wore hoodies. Naomi was a trauma survivor, hyper-vigilant. She'd mentioned fear of being followed before, but Elise's gut said otherwise. She pulled out her phone and scrolled through her messages with Caleb. Their last conversation was from the night before. He had sent a voice memo, a soft, low whisper that still echoed in her mind. "I keep thinking about how you looked that first day. You were so calm, so sure. I wonder what you'd do if you really saw all of me." Now she wondered if she had seen anything at all. The next day, Elise cancelled her afternoon sessions. She told her receptionist it was a migraine. She needed space to think, to investigate, to breathe. She opened Caleb's intake form again, barely any information. No emergency contact, no past therapists listed, no medical history. How had she not noticed that before? She opened her search engine and typed his name, Caleb Munro. Nothing helpful, no LinkedIn, no background checks. She tried combining it with different cities. Still nothing solid. Then, on a hunch, she checked court records and found him. Not under criminal cases, but small claims. 2 years ago, a woman named Erica Jennings filed a restraining order against a Caleb Munro in the same state. It was dismissed due to insufficient evidence, but the case notes were brief and chilling. Plaintiff claims emotional coercion and targeted harassment, alleged impersonation of mental health professionals, and infiltration of support group. Elise's stomach dropped. She looked at the photo attached to the filing. It was grainy, but unmistakable. It was him. That evening, Elise sat in her dark kitchen, wine untouched, phone in her hand. She dialed. Caleb answered on the second ring. "Elise," he said, soft and warm. "Miss me already?" She stayed silent. He paused. "Everything okay?" "Did you follow one of my clients?" she asked, voice low and cold. A breath, a shift in tone. "What are you talking about?" "Naomi. She said someone was watching her, described you, drew your face." Silence. Then, laughter. Low, controlled. "Are you serious?" he said. "You think I'd follow someone else when I have you? Don't lie to me." He snapped. "Don't talk to me like that." The words were sharp, unfamiliar. Then he shifted again. "You know what happens to people who jump to conclusions? They lose everything." The threat wasn't loud, but it was there. The next morning, Elise walked into her office early. She closed the door, pulled out a blank file, and started documenting everything. Every session with Caleb, every gift, every hotel meetup, every moment she'd crossed a line. It wasn't just fear anymore. It was strategy. She had to protect herself, her license, her other clients. She printed the restraining order, slid it into a folder marked contingency. She wasn't sure if she was building a case or preparing for an explosion. Maybe both. But the explosion came faster than she expected. 2 days later, her receptionist, Mallory, came into her office looking pale. "There's a woman outside asking about you," she whispered. "She says she's your boyfriend's ex." Elise froze. "What's her name?" She wouldn't say, just that it's about Caleb. She looks upset. Elise stood up slowly. "Tell her I'm not available." But it was too late. The woman pushed past Mallory into the hallway. She looked mid-30s, hair in a bun, eyes wild with anger and something worse, grief. "I warned him not to do this again," she hissed. "You think you're the first? You're not. You're just next." "Please leave," Elise said firmly. The woman laughed bitterly. "That man doesn't love anyone. He hunts, he mimics, and when he's done, he moves on. I lost my job, my apartment. I almost lost my life." Mallory tried to usher her out, but the woman threw something onto the floor before storming away. It was a flash drive, labelled, "For when you finally stop lying to yourself." That night, Elise plugged it into her laptop. It contained a folder of screenshots, emails, voice memos, videos, all from Caleb, to different women, different names, but the same tone, the same charm, the same words. "You're the only one who sees me. Don't tell anyone. They'll never understand. If you leave me, I'll ruin you." One video was filmed secretly, Caleb in someone else's apartment, opening a file cabinet, taking photos of medical records. Elise shut her laptop and covered her mouth. She wanted to vomit. This wasn't an affair anymore. It was a pattern, a system, a predator using therapy like a weapon. And she had handed him the keys. The next morning, she called her lawyer. "I need to talk," she said, off the record. Later that week, Elise met with the State Ethics Board's internal investigator under a confidential disclosure clause. She didn't use Caleb's name, not yet, but she outlined the situation, the manipulation, the fear, the breach. "You do realise," the investigator said slowly, "that if this becomes public, your licence may not survive, even if you were manipulated." Elise nodded. "I'd rather lose my licence," she whispered, "than lose another client." But it was already too late. The next day, Naomi was found unconscious in her apartment after an overdose. Not fatal, but close. Her sister found her just in time. When Elise visited her in the hospital, Naomi whispered, "He told me you were using me, said you shared my secrets. I thought he was trying to protect me. He knew things no one else did." Elise's heart stopped. She had never mentioned Naomi's name around Caleb. But she had kept client files in her home, and Caleb had stayed there once, just once. The next time he called, Elise didn't answer. The next time he showed up at her office, Mallory locked the door, and the next morning, Caleb was gone. No trace. No social media, no phone, no forwarding address. He vanished the same way he had appeared, as if conjured out of nowhere, but the damage stayed. The ethics board launched a formal review. Elise went on unpaid leave. Her name spread in quiet whispers through her professional circles, and in the silence that followed, Elise stared at her own reflection and asked a question she never imagined asking. Did I fall in love? Or was I chosen? They say therapists are trained to see the truth, but no amount of training prepares you for the day your own instincts betray you. Dr. Elise Hartman sat in front of the small oval mirror in her guest bathroom. No makeup, no clinical armour, just bare skin, sleepless eyes, and the guilt of someone who had crossed every line she once taught others never to approach. She stared hard at herself. Not the way you check for flaws or fix your hair. This was the kind of stare reserved for liars. She whispered, "Did I really believe him? Or did I just want someone to need me that badly?" Her house had become a fortress of paranoia. Every sound outside made her flinch. Her phone stayed on silent. Her laptop was closed. The only thing that moved was the ceiling fan spinning above her bed, like an accusation. She hadn't heard from Caleb in 9 days, but his silence was louder than anything he ever said. The ethics board had frozen her license pending investigation. Her lawyer advised silence, no contact with Caleb, no contact with clients, no statements to the press. "You're not just protecting your reputation," he said, "you're protecting your freedom." But the worst part wasn't the potential criminal charge. It was the question she couldn't shake. How many others had he used her to reach? Elise pulled out the client logs from the last 3 months. It was a paper trail of routine. Naomi, Liz, Margot. A few teens referred from a youth shelter, all vulnerable, all struggling. She noticed something. Naomi had once mentioned a safe place she went to, a book cafe near her apartment. Two other clients, completely unrelated, had also mentioned the same cafe in recent months. None of them knew each other. All of them had trauma histories related to male figures. And all of them had described a man watching them. Not threatening, just observing. Elise felt her stomach twist. She picked up her phone and called Margot. "Margot, it's Dr. Hartman." A pause. "Oh, I wasn't expecting to hear from you." "I know. I'm not calling as your therapist. I'm just concerned. I need to ask, have you noticed anything strange lately? Anyone showing up where you go?" Another pause. A different kind. "Yeah," Margot said softly. "I thought I was going crazy. A guy at the bookstore, just sitting there reading. But he was always there, even when I changed days."
"Did he ever talk to you?"
"Number. But once, I dropped my journal in the parking lot. When I came back for it, it was gone. Next day, it was back in my mailbox." Elise's chest tightened. "Do you remember what he looked like?"
"Tall, dark hoodie. I didn't see his face clearly, but his shoes, black boots. One had a torn lace. I remember because I almost tripped on it once."
Caleb. That was the exact description of what he wore the night he left Elise's house the first time. She hung up and opened her laptop. This time, she searched differently. Not for Caleb Monroe, but for patterns. She looked into online forums, Reddit threads, therapy survivor blogs, places where people wrote about unethical therapists and toxic relationships. Buried deep in one forum, titled "Survivors of Fake Counselors," she found a story, posted anonymously. "He said he was in therapy for trauma, said he was close with his therapist, talked about the women she treated. He knew things I'd never told anyone. It felt like he was reading my mind. He made me believe he loved me. Then he said if I told anyone, he'd expose my history, my real name, my records. I don't even know how he got them. I thought I was healing, but I was just being harvested." The post ended with, "If you're reading this and you're a therapist, check your files, check your house, check yourself." Elise stared at the screen until her vision blurred. Then she went to her hallway closet and unlocked the cabinet where she kept backup copies of her client files. It was an old system, but she liked paper, trusted it more than digital notes. She flipped through the folders one by one. Everything seemed untouched until she got to the folder labelled Confidential-DV Group. Inside were the profiles of four women she had been prepping for a private group session on recovery from domestic violence, all vulnerable, all recent. And one folder was missing. Margot's. She sank to the floor. She hadn't imagined it. Caleb had taken it, read it, used it. And now he was gone, with everything he needed to break those women apart. She knew what she had to do next. She printed out the missing folder's contents from her digital backup, packed every file into a locked briefcase, and drove straight to the investigator's office. She walked in without an appointment. "I want to file a formal criminal report," she said. The investigator raised an eyebrow. "You're aware of what that means, right?
you'll be admitting to boundary violations. If you go public with this, there's no turning back. Elise nodded. I don't care about my career anymore, she said. I care about the women who still think he's something he's not. 3 days later, a detective contacted her. A real investigation was now underway, but Caleb had vanished. No phone record, no family. His identity was paper thin, possibly even fake. The name Caleb Monroe might not have been real at all. They checked his payment method. It was cash, the hotels, booked under aliases, the emails, encrypted. The only trace he left was in the broken people he manipulated, and Elise was one of them. She began to write every detail, every message, every session with him, not as notes for the case, but as a confession, a chronicle, a way to stop the bleeding. She titled the document The Mirror Test, because that's what it had become. A way to ask herself, how did I not see it? Then, one night, a letter arrived. No return address. Inside was a single page, handwritten. You were the most fun. I never expected a therapist to fall that fast. But then again, you needed me as much as I needed you. Don't worry, I've moved on. Keep helping the broken. It makes them easier to find. See, she burned the letter in her sink. But the smoke didn't take away the guilt. Elise never knew how loud silence could be until the day her office was shuttered. No ringing phone, no murmurs through the waiting room, no knock on the door from a nervous first-timer holding trauma like a secret. Just empty walls and that cold, sterile scent of a place once filled with stories. She stood in the middle of it all, arms crossed, the last of her personal belongings in a cardboard box. Her degrees, a half-burnt candle, a framed quote that used to inspire her. The wound is the place where the light enters you. Rumi. Now it felt like a cruel joke. The state board had suspended her indefinitely. Her malpractice insurer had quietly dropped her. Word had spread among therapists in the area. No one said anything to her directly. They didn't have to. She had become untouchable. And that's when the letters started arriving. The first was typed, no return address. You're a disgrace to this profession. People like you ruin lives. The second was handwritten. I trusted you. You let a predator into the room. The third simply said, we know who he hurt. We know who let him in. Each one chipped away at her resolve. But the one that broke her came from Naomi's sister. Naomi's not the same. She doesn't trust anyone. She won't even leave her apartment. You were supposed to protect her. Instead, you brought him into her world. Whatever he did to her, you let it happen. Maybe not on purpose, but you still let it happen. Elise read it 3 times, folded it neatly, slipped it into the folder with Caleb's voice memos and printed screenshots, not to keep, to remember. 2 weeks later, Detective Angela Reyes rang her doorbell. She wore plain clothes, no badge showing, and carried a manila folder tucked under her arm. Can I come in? Elise stepped aside. Reyes sat at the kitchen table like she'd been there before, calm, methodical, direct. We've connected Caleb, or whatever his real name is, to at least 3 confirmed cases now, all in different cities, all involving women under psychiatric or trauma-informed care. Same approach, same manipulation, same vanishing act. She slid the folder toward Elise. Inside were photos, 3 women, all with that same empty stare Elise had seen in Naomi. One of them had died by suicide. Elise felt the blood drain from her face. Reyes didn't soften. We also recovered fragments from a burner phone in a pawn shop. There were photos of documents, notes, voice memos. Most of them seemed to have been taken in your home. Elise nodded slowly. I think he stole them the night he slept over. I didn't know then what he was doing. Rhea studied her. Number, I don't think you did, but you're a trained professional. You knew what transference was. Counter-transference, you knew better. I did, Elise whispered. So why didn't you stop? That question lived inside Elise like a sickness. She kept replaying those early sessions, the vulnerability in his voice, the slow build of trust, the manipulation she'd only seen later, in hindsight. But there was something else too, the part of her that wanted to believe him, that felt chosen, special, needed. It wasn't just Caleb's fault. It was hers too. Then came the day Margot disappeared. It was a Sunday. She'd been scheduled to speak at a small women's group, something Elise had once helped her plan. When she didn't show and didn't answer calls, her roommate filed a report. Elise found out from a news alert. Margot Thorne, 27, missing for over 36 hours. Last seen near her apartment bookstore. Police reviewing surveillance footage. Elise didn't wait. She drove straight to the detective's office. He's escalating, she said the moment Reyes appeared. He doesn't just want to observe anymore. He wants to control the narrative. He's playing God now. Reyes looked tense. We're pulling street footage, a TM logs. Her phone last pinged 3 blocks from her home before going dark. Check every shelter, every safe house, Elise said. He won't hurt her immediately. He needs her to believe in him first. Reyes raised an eyebrow. How do you know? Because that's what he did to me. By Tuesday, they found her. Not in a ditch, not in a hospital, but in a rented house 30 miles outside the city. The landlord called in a complaint after hearing loud shouting followed by silence. Inside, police found Margot, shaken, dehydrated, but alive. She was lying on a mattress in a room with blackout curtains, a single lamp, and a small pile of torn notebooks. Caleb was gone, but the walls were covered in handwritten notes, quotes from therapy, words Elise had once said to him in session. You are not broken. You are just carrying too much alone. Sometimes the deepest wounds are disguised as love. Next to them were newspaper clippings of Elise's suspension, and one chilling phrase written in red marker, she lied to me too. Margot wouldn't talk at first, not to the police, not to her family, but when she finally did, it was to Elise. They met at the hospital, under strict supervision. Elise didn't wear her usual blazer, no badge of expertise, just a woman with nothing left to hide. Margot's first words cut straight through her. You said this was a safe space. Elise nodded. It was, until I failed to protect it. Margot wiped her eyes. He said you were in love with him, that you gave him my file, that you told him I was weak. Elise closed her eyes. None of that is true. But I let him close enough to figure you out. That's on me. I believed him, Margot whispered, even when it didn't feel right, because he sounded like you. That was the deepest cut of all. After Margot's recovery, the case gained traction. Detective Reyes pushed for a full manhunt. Elise agreed to testify, provide records, and even allow media coverage. She knew her name would be torn apart in the process, but maybe it would save the next woman. She sat down for an anonymous interview with a national podcast about abuse within therapy. Voice distorted, no names, just facts. At the end of the episode, the host asked, if you could speak to him directly, what would you say? Elise thought for a long time. Then she answered, I would say I see you now, not the mask, not the story, the real you, and even if you run forever, you'll never be invisible again. But Caleb wasn't done. A new message appeared in her email inbox one morning. No subject, just a voice recording. She clicked play. I liked Margot. She reminded me of you before you got cold, before you started fighting back. But don't worry, I'm not coming back. Not yet. I just wanted to say, thanks. You made me better at what I do. The message ended with a single breath. A satisfied one. Before Elise ever met Caleb, she believed everyone had a core truth. No matter how damaged or defensive, beneath it all lived something real, something human. That belief shaped her work. It gave her purpose. Now, sitting at the back of a courtroom during another woman's testimony, she wasn't sure she believed that anymore. Because Caleb Monroe, or whatever his name really was, didn't wear a mask to hide who he was. The mask was who he was. The courtroom was cold, wood-panelled walls, quiet whispers, a judge with tired eyes and a docket of delays. The woman on the stand, identified only as E.M., trembled as she recounted how Caleb had entered her life through a peer-led grief support group. He'd said he lost a sister, claimed he was still recovering, cried during his first share. He stayed after meetings, asked about her, listened deeply, gently. Within 3 weeks, he was in her home. Within 4, he had a copy of her keys. He told me he loved me, she said, voice cracking. Then he said, if I ever left him, he'd make sure I couldn't get custody of my daughter. Elise closed her eyes. Different woman. Same script. The DA now had testimonies from 6 women. All vulnerable. All isolated. All under professional or peer mental health care. The timeline stretched back 4 years. Sometimes he stayed in town for months. Other times, just long enough to shatter someone. He never used the same name twice. Monroe, Wallace, Reeve, Carson. But he always told the same story. A broken man searching for someone who understood. After the hearing, Elise walked outside. The air was crisp and grey, as if even the sky knew better than to shine. She found Detective Reyes leaning against her car. You okay? Reyes asked. Elise gave a humourless laugh. Define okay. Reyes nodded, pulling out a thin folder. We got something. Inside were surveillance photos from a hotel security cam in Knoxville, Tennessee, just 2 days earlier. Caleb, or someone matching his build, checking in under the name Ian DeWitt. The timestamp was only 36 hours old. Reyes folded her arms. He's getting sloppy, staying in one place too long. Maybe he's finally slipping. Elise shook her head. Number, he wants us to find him. That night, Elise couldn't sleep. Her nightmares had shifted. Before, it was the guilt. The faces of Naomi, Margot, the others. Now, it was him. Not hurting anyone, just smiling, watching. Always just out of reach, she went to her study and reopened the folder labelled Caleb Evidence Archive. She'd been building it quietly, in secret, not for court, for herself. His emails, his voice notes, transcripts of their sessions, all compiled, all marked. She'd gone back and listened to their early recordings again, the ones from their legitimate therapy sessions. That's when she noticed it. He never answered questions directly. He avoided specifics, never used last names, and he always redirected deep emotional topics back to Elise. Not to manipulate her compassion, but to mirror her pain. She pulled out her old therapist log, the one she stopped writing in after things got personal. She reread her entry from week 2. There's something about him, something familiar. Now she knew what it was. He had been studying her from the very first minute. The next morning, Elise asked to meet with Reyes and the DA. She came with a theory. "He doesn't just seek out damaged women," she said. "He builds his personality out of their stories. Their pain becomes his disguise." Reyes narrowed her eyes. "You're saying he doesn't just lie? He reconstructs himself?" "Yes," Elise said. "And if we map the similarities in each woman's trauma history, we might predict who he'll target next." The DA leaned forward. "You think he's still hunting?" Elise didn't flinch. "Number, I think he's performing, and the audience is growing." 1 week later, Knoxville. A break in the case. A nurse named Leah Whitman reported a man matching Caleb's description had been attending grief counselling under the name Ian DeWitt, claimed he'd lost a partner to suicide, was deeply emotionally intelligent, wrote poetry, brought flowers for other attendees. He hadn't done anything overt, not yet. But Leah said he'd taken an odd interest in a woman named Cassie, a quiet, recently divorced mother recovering from emotional abuse. Elise didn't wait for permission. She drove down. Cassie was thin, pale, barely made eye contact. Elise met her in the back room of a shelter where the support group gathered. She didn't reveal everything, just enough to keep Cassie cautious. Sometimes people with bad intentions know exactly what to say, Elise said gently. Cassie's voice was barely above a whisper. "He said he'd been through what I had. He made me feel seen, not judged." Elise nodded. "That's what he does." Then she showed her a photo. Cassie flinched. "That's him, but he called himself Ian." With Cassie's testimony, police had cause to move. But again, Caleb was gone, left his hotel room spotless, his toothbrush in the trash, half a bottle of cologne still on the counter, a sticky note on the mirror, "Almost caught me, try again." The task force now had a confirmed identity. Fingerprints matched a man named Jonas Keller, once reported missing at 19 after fleeing a foster care system in New York. No criminal record, no family ties. He had erased his past before becoming everyone else's future mistake. Elise returned home and stood in her dark living room. Rain tapped against the windows. She stared at her reflection again, no longer looking for truth, now searching for what she had left. She wasn't a therapist anymore. Her name was tarnished, her license suspended indefinitely, her reputation in shreds. But she had something else now. Clarity. She knew how predators like him survived. They relied on silence, on shame, on the hope that their victims would never speak, or worse, never believe themselves. And Elise Hartman was done being quiet. Jonas Keller, that was his real name, born in upstate New York, aged out of foster care at 18, vanished by 19. No college records, no driver's license, no tax filings, just a footprint that ended as soon as he learned how to hide it. Elise stared at the file Reyes gave her, trying to match that name to the man who once sat in her therapy room and cried about a locked shed and an abusive father. There had never been a shed. There had never been a father. Only a boy who disappeared and re-emerged as whatever people needed him to be. But this time, Elise wasn't following. She was leading. It began with a single post, an anonymous blog entry, written from a burner account Elise created under the name The Broken Mirror. She described Jonas, not just his crimes, but his tactics, how he used transference and mirrored language, how he infiltrated mental health spaces with surgical precision. She gave advice for identifying his patterns, language to look out for, emotions that didn't add up. She didn't name him. She didn't need to. The post went viral. Dozens of comments poured in. people describing similar encounters, men who said all the right things too soon, who knew too much, who got too close. Some were likely unrelated, but a few matched Jonas's playbook exactly. Reyes called her 2 days later. "What are you doing?" the detective asked, voice tight. "I'm flushing him out," Elise said. "You're also exposing yourself to liability. If he sees this..." "He's already seen it." Elise opened her laptop and showed her latest message. From encrypted address. Subject, let's play. "You always needed a project. Glad I could still be useful." "You're not the hunter. You're just another woman who couldn't keep her hands off me." "But if you want to find me so badly, you'll have to come look." It wasn't just a taunt. It was a lead. Attached to the email was an audio file, 5 seconds long, a train horn, a background announcement, then a muffled voice, Jonas's voice, saying, "The trick is knowing when the mirror's facing you." Elise sent the file to Reyes. It took a full day, but they matched the background audio to a transit announcement from Chicago's Union Station. Jonas had slipped again. This time, Elise went with law enforcement. No more solo trips. No more improvising. The FBI had taken interest now. The case crossed state lines. Multiple aliases. Multiple victims. It was no longer just a local investigation. It was a hunt for a serial psychological predator. They tracked purchases made with a burner card at a corner store downtown. Energy drinks, a prepaid cell, a notebook. Surveillance cameras caught a man in a blue hoodie leaving the store at 1:47 a.m. They got one clean frame. It was him. The next evening, Elise received another email. "You're close. Almost impressed. But you always were better at diagnosing pain than surviving it. Let's see how far you're willing to go. But be careful. You're starting to look obsessed." She didn't flinch. She was obsessed. Because Jonas wasn't just dangerous, he was smart. And that made him lethal. Later that week, a woman named Danielle contacted Elise through her blog. She was a trauma counsellor in Chicago. Said a man named Liam Carson had joined her small group therapy circle 6 weeks ago. Claimed he lost his wife in a house fire. Quiet, thoughtful, wrote poetry. Carried a journal filled with quotes. Elise asked for one quote. Danielle typed back, "Even mirrors lie, depending on the light." Elise froze. That was a phrase she had once written in Caleb's, Jonas's, session summary notes. He'd copied her, again. With Danielle's help, Reyes got a wire on the next group session. It was held at a non-profit trauma centre downtown. Jonas had attended the last 3 meetings, never disruptive, always the observer. They didn't arrest him during the session. That wasn't the point. They followed him afterward. He walked alone for 2 blocks, turned down an alley. That's where they moved in. He didn't resist, didn't run, didn't even look surprised. He just smiled when they cuffed him. And when Reyes read him his rights, he said calmly, "Took you long enough." At the station, Jonas refused to speak to anyone, except Elise. He requested it by name, signed the form. "I'll only talk to Dr. Elise Hartman, privately." Reyes brought her the request. "This is your call," she said. "You don't have to do this." "I know." Elise stared at the page, at the signature. It didn't say Caleb Monroe. It didn't say Liam Carson. It said Jonas Elijah Keller. She nodded. "Let's do it." They placed her in a secure room, glass between them, 2 agents behind a wall with audio feed. Elise entered with no bag, no pen, nothing he could twist. Jonas was already seated, clean-shaven, calm, eyes sharp. "Hello, Elise," he said softly. "You look tired." "I am." They stared at each other for a moment, not as therapist and client, not even as predator and victim. Just two people who knew each other's darkness.
"You made me better," he said.
"Did you know that?" She said nothing. "I used to get sloppy," Jonas went on, "emotional. But with you, I learned patience, discipline. I learned how to wear pain like a coat. That's a gift, you know. Pain. It opens doors." She finally spoke. "You're not in control anymore." Jonas smiled.
"You think so?"
"I know so."
He leaned forward, his face cold.
"You still don't get it, do you? You didn't fall for me. You fell for your reflection. The version of you that believed she could save anyone. Even a man made of lies."
Elise didn't blink.
"And yet here you are, behind glass, behind bars, and I'm walking out of this room free."
Jonas grinned, but the cracks showed. There was fear behind his eyes now, small but real. Elise stood. "Goodbye, Jonas." She didn't look back. That night, she wrote the final entry in her blog, "When you stare long enough into the broken mirror, you don't just see the monster. You see yourself, what you missed, what you ignored, and what you survived." He thought he wore the mask, but we all wear one. Mine was believing I couldn't be fooled. Now, I wear something else. Clarity, accountability, and the will to never be silent again. 6 months later, Elise Hartman stood in front of a crowded auditorium. No white coat, no clinical detachment, just a microphone, a chair, and a truth she could no longer carry alone. The banner above her read, "Ethics in Mental Health, Boundaries, Betrayal, and Becoming Whole." She wasn't there as a keynote expert. She was there as a cautionary tale. "My name is Elise Hartman," she said clearly, voice steady, mic in hand. "I was a licensed trauma therapist for over 10 years. I believed I was immune to manipulation, that my training, my experience, my self-awareness made me safe. But predators don't need brute force to destroy you. Sometimes all they need is for you to believe you're the exception." She paused, scanning the room. Dozens of therapists, students, and survivors stared back at her, silent, waiting. "I crossed boundaries with a man who presented as a patient. He told me stories of abuse, of trauma, of loneliness. He studied me as much as I thought I was studying him. I believed him. I fell for him. And because of that, other people were hurt." A hush fell over the room. "I don't tell you this for sympathy. I tell you this because if it can happen to me, it can happen to any of us. And if we don't talk about the shame, it becomes the next predator's camouflage." When Elise stepped down, the room stood, not in applause, but in recognition. Jonas Keller had been formally indicted 2 months earlier on 7 counts, including identity fraud, coercive control, and psychological abuse across multiple states. There would likely be more charges, more victims, more names. But at least now, there would be a trail. Elise's medical license remained suspended. She had voluntarily withdrawn from practice, not under protest, but with intention. Her life had changed. She had changed. She wasn't here to diagnose anymore. She was here to witness, to warn, to rebuild, not others, but herself. She moved to a small cottage 2 hours outside the city. No neighbours, no clients, just open fields and silence that didn't feel threatening anymore. She started writing a book, a real one, not about Jonas, about her, about how healers break, about how boundaries can bend into bruises, about how silence can kill more than voices ever could. The working title was Simple Reflections. One morning, she checked her mail and found a letter with no return address. Her chest tightened, but the handwriting wasn't his. It was Naomi's. She opened it with shaking fingers. Dr. Hartman Dash, I don't know if you'll ever go back to practicing, but I want you to know I forgive you. You're not the one who hurt me. You're the one who warned me, even when it cost you everything. I'm in school now, studying psychology. I want to help people too, but this time I won't be naive. Thank you for showing me that the line between victim and survivor is honesty, and sometimes that honesty starts with ourselves. Elise read the letter twice, then a third time. She sat in her garden as the wind moved through the trees, and for the first time in over a year, she cried. Not from shame, from release. 2 years later, the podcast Elise had once appeared on anonymously invited her back, this time under her real name. They titled the episode, The Woman Who Turned the Mirror Around. It became one of the most shared mental health episodes of the year, not because of the scandal, but because of the truth. Jonas Keller was eventually sentenced to 12 years in prison, not for love, not for sex, but for psychological trespassing, a term that had never before been used in a courtroom the way it was that day, Elise testified. She looked him in the eye. He didn't smile this time. He didn't say a word. Before she left, she walked past the victim's bench and stopped beside Naomi, Margot, Danielle, and Cassie, the women he had studied, used, and tried to erase. She said four simple words. You were never crazy. Elise now speaks at universities, trains trauma-informed therapists, and mentors young women entering the mental health field. She doesn't hide what happened. She doesn't glorify it either. She tells the truth. Because sometimes the only way to heal is to let the wound be seen. She ends every talk with the same sentence. The worst thing you can do to a predator is survive him loud. And she means it.